Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Please come to the Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Canto 11, Chapter 14, text number 20. Na sarayati bhanjogo. Na sankhyam dharma udhavam. Na sadyayasta paschago. Yita bhaktir namorjita. Na. Not. Sadhyati brings under control. Me. Yoga. The system of the yogi system. Na. Nor. Sankhyam. The system of Sankhya philosophy. Dharmaha. Pious activities within the Varnashram system. Uddhava, Madhya Uddhava. Not. Sadhyayaha, Vedic study. Tapaha, austerity. Chagya, renunciation. Ita, as. Bhakti, devotional service. Naam, unto me. Orajita, strongly developed. Translation. My dear Uddhava, the unalloyed devotional service rendered to me by my devotees brings me under their control. I cannot be thus controlled by those engaged in mystic yoga, Sankhya philosophy, pious work, Vedic study, austerity or renunciation. Purport. One may make Krishna the goal of mystic yoga, Sankhya philosophy, etc., yet such activities do not please the Lord as much as direct loving service, which one practices by hearing and chanting about the Lord and executing his mission. Śrīla Rūpa Gosvāmī states, Jñāna karma jñābhṛtam. A devotee should simply depend on Krishna and should not unnecessarily complicate his loving service with tendencies toward fruitive work or mental speculation. The residents of Vrindavan simply depend on Lord Krishna. When the great serpent Agasura appeared in the precincts of Braja, the cowherd boys, completely confident in their friendship with Lord Krishna, fearlessly march into the serpent's gigantic mouth. Such pure love for Krishna brings the Lord under the control of the devotee. Na sariti mam yoga na sankhyam dhanamurva na sadyayasta paschago itharabhatiyam amojita. My dear Uddhava, the unalloyed devotional service rendered to me by my devotees brings me under their control. I cannot be thus controlled by those engaged in mystic yoga, Sankhya philosophy, pious work, Vedic study, austerity or renunciation. So, Krishna is, in these series of verses, is making it very clear to Uddhava and thus everyone within the universe that devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, pure devotional service, unalloyed devotional service, is the topmost practice, spiritual practice, which brings about the topmost perfection. So in many different ways Krishna is clarifying this point. And here he is specifically stating the other processes in their principal forms. And certainly many people who practice Sankhya philosophy, mystic yoga, renunciation, austerity, Vedic study, many of those may think that any path that you follow is as good as another, and that it simply depends upon a person's personal predilection, or that they may feel that these other paths, such as mystic yoga, Sankhya philosophy and what have you, are non-different from bhakti. And yet here Krishna is making a clear distinction that there is unalloyed devotional service and there are other processes. They are not the same thing and they do not give the same result. Here, in the very first sentence, a very interesting statement that one may make Krishna the goal of mystic yoga, Sankhya philosophy, etc., yet such activities do not please the Lord as much as direct loving service. So there, of course, in that statement we understand that there are many different people who actually are considered Vaishnavas, because externally they worship Krishna or Vishnu, but actually not everyone that worships Krishna or Vishnu is actually a Vaishnava. Very common when because I meet a lot of the Indian congregation. And most of them claim to be Vaishnavas. we are Vaishnavas. And I know in the beginning I was thinking, oh, this is wonderful, so many Vaishnavas. And gradually, as I realized what they're actually following, I understood that not everyone that calls himself a Vaishnava, or even who worships Vishnu, or even worships Krishna, is actually a Vaishnava. Srila Prabhupada made that very clear in those exact words. He was discussing with one Indologist, very famous Indologist in America, and he was asking him a series of questions. Srila Prabhupada explained that the impersonators who follow Sankaracharya, there is recommended in the Vedas Panchapasana, which is that there are five principal gods that one may worship: the sun god, Shiva, Ganesh, Durga or Kali, and Vishnu. Vishnu would include the other various avatars that manifest from Vishnu, such as Krishna. Some people would consider Krishna to be one of the pastimes of Vishnu. So the impersonalists consider that because God is ultimately impersonal, you can actually choose one of these imaginary forms of the Lord, imaginary in the sense that they're temporary. You can worship that form of the Lord, and when you achieve perfection, then you reject that imaginary form of the Lord because you've actually become one with the impersonal Brahman. So therefore, there are many Brahmanas and who claim to be Vaishnavas. They worship Vishnu, they may even worship Krishna, but actually they're impersonalists, they're not Vaishnavas at all. But their activities, you know, are very similar to what we do. They will go to a temple of Krishna, worship Vishnu, they perform aarti, they'll even chant the holy names of the Lord and so many different things. But they're not Vaishnavas. There are another example, of course, in the ten offences of the Lord, the eighth offence. What is the eighth offence? To consider the glories of the chain of the holy names of the Lord to be one of the auspicious ritualistic activities which are often devoted to food activities, karma kanda. So there are many people who consider that the chanting of the holy names of the Lord is another pious activity, just as there are many other pious activities in the Vedas. They don't understand that it is actually a transcendental activity. Of course, if they perform the chanting of the holy names of the Lord as a ritualistic type ceremony, they don't really get the transcendental effect because of the offensive mentality that may be there, considering it to be an ordinary material activity. So you know, they will claim, people will claim, of course, that you know, all things represent the truth. So Shiva represents the truth, the absolute truth. Durga represents the absolute truth. And Ganesh represents the absolute truth. Vishnu represents the absolute truth. Krishna. So because they all represent the absolute truth, they all are the absolute truth, and you can just you know, contact the absolute truth through any of these different forms. But that is not a fact. Srila Prabhupada gives an example that of course from the Brahma Samhita, that yogurt, so for instance people worship Lord Shiva thinking that that is as good as worshipping Vishnu or Krishna. Yogurt is non-different from milk, but if you have yogurt, you can't derive the benefits that you would get from having milk. You actually get a different effect. Generally, the effect that people get from worshipping Shiva is material opulence. As far as bhakti, that effect is not there. And again, another example Srila Prabhupada gives is that the truth is there, but it is not manifest to everyone in the same way that within milk there is butter. But unless the milk is properly churned, the butter is not manifest. So in the same way, the truth is there, but unless there is bhakti, which actually churns the absolute truth, the manifestation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and does not fully manifest, one will get some different effect. One will not get the full effect. So by bhakti, it is like churning milk. One produces the full effect, or the essence that is there within the milk, and by bhakti one gets the essence which is there, the essence of the absolute truth, which is Lord Sri Krishna. So you know, people make many, many different statements which are all very easily defeated. Just like you know, again, people will say you worship any god and you will get to the same destination. of course, we understand that, you know, if you buy a plane ticket to Perth, you will not get to Cairns. It's a ridiculous proposition. You'll never get there. All paths don't lead to the same destination. So, but the majority of people who practice Vaishnavism are actually impersonalists. Many of the smarter brahmanas, and so many people who worship Vishnu and even Krishna, but there's no bhakti there. then you have those who, for instance, do the Bhagavad Saptaha. So they recite the Srimad Bhagavatam, and they're always discussing Krishna's pastime. So you would think that they are, that there is some bhakti there, but there is no bhakti. It is a way of earning a livelihood. They consider it a pious activity, like that, and therefore, after that, Bhagavat Saptaha recitation, the Srimad Bhagavatam in 7 days. They go back to their life of sense gratification, the speaker, and all the hearers go back to their life of sense gratification, and they consider that there's a little trace of piety there, certainly by hearing the Bhagavatam. So in this way you see that, there are so many people who, hear about Krishna and Vishnu and worship, and even, call themselves Vaishnavas, but they're not Vaishnavas at all. So here Krishna is saying that unless there is, this unalloyed devotional service, that is the activity which actually attracts the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and what to speak of other processes where they're not even worshipping Krishna or, Vishnu Tattva, such as Lord Ram, what have you. Even those who are worshipping Krishna or Vishnu Tattva, if that bhakti is not there, it doesn't attract Krishna, even if there is some, piety involved in that activity, even if there's some austerities being performed, even if there's some, sankhya, some determined effort to distinguish between matter and spirit, even there's vast study of the Vedic literatures, none of that actually attracts Krishna. So Krishna is making a definite distinction between these activities and unalloyed devotional service. Here he makes the statement that unalloyed devotional service rendered by his devotees actually brings him under their control, but other processes cannot control Krishna. So there's a Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teaches us Nādanam nājanam nāsandiram kavitam vājagirishikam mahi mamma jannamini jannamini svare abhavatāda bhakti ahoitiki twayi. That, O my Lord, I have no desire to accumulate wealth, nor do I desire beautiful women, nor do I want any number of followers. I only want your causeless devotional service, birth after birth. Now, here in that verse, the fourth verse of the Sushastikam, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is presenting that in order for one to come to the platform of pure devotional service, one has to have no other desires. And the same sentiment is, of course, expressed by Śrīla Rūpa Gosvāmī in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Gyanād karmād yanavṛtam What's his name? Anukulina Krishna. What's his name? Yes. That one should render pure devotional service. In order to render pure devotional service, it needs to be free from activities of karma, jnana, and other processes of like yoga. And it needs to be, without any other ulterior motive. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sishastika prayer is saying the same thing. Nādhanam nājanam nāsundariyam kavitam bhajagirishikamaye mama janmini janmineshvare bhavatad bhakti ahiteki twai. Nādhanam means, wealth, but it also includes all the piety which is accrued by fruit of activities. That is the wealth of the karmis, that they accrue huge amounts of pious activities, and that gives them the opportunity to enjoy, become first class enjoyers of the material world. Basically, as Srila Prabhupada says, they're karma misra bhaktas. If they're, if they're worshipping Vishnu and sometimes even Krishna, but they're doing it in order to accrue pious activities so that they can become first class enjoyers of the material world, then they're at best karma misra bhaktas, mixed bhakti. It also, their wealth is also all the paraphernalia necessary for their, enjoyment in the material world, in this life and the next. That is all their wealth. Nādhanam, nājanam, followers, one's wife, children, servants, the subjects of the king, one's friends and relatives, they're all followers. Najanam na sundarim. Sundarim, beautiful wife. Najanam sundarim kavitam. So if you actually put the two words together, sundarim kavitam, it also means they're also not attracted to the flowery words of the Vedas. There are many the devotees of the Lord don't take interest in any dry discussions which are devoid of topics of bhakti, which are devoid of topics of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, His glories, His pastimes, like that. They're not interested in, no matter how wonderful those discussions are, you see that the whole world is filled with volumes and volumes of literature. They have this thesis and this theory and this philosophy and this remedy and this they discuss everything backwards and forwards, up and down, inside out. And not a speck of, it is all dry, because you cannot find anything related to Krishna anywhere. Even sometimes it's very beautifully presented, very flowery, very eloquent, devotees have no attraction to that. So, kavitam, sundarin kavitam, mahma janmani janmanishvare, that the devotee is not even interested in liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Bhavatata bhakti ahoitiki utvayi. Their only interest is in this ahoitiki, unmotivated, pure devotional service, birth after birth. So that, the devotee's prayer is that, as it's described here, they completely depend on Krishna for everything. And they're not asking Krishna for anything, only the desire to serve Krishna and to the opportunity to please Krishna by that service with no personal desire in any other field and no motivation for that service, completely unalloyed devotion, that is the devotee's mood. And they pray that, you know, as long as I continue to remain within this material world, birth after birth, then let me just have pure devotional service like that. So, and when the Lord desires, of course, then I will return back to Godhead. Of course, we should understand that the Lord does desire that we return back to Godhead. So, you know, quite often devotees ask the question that somehow it's a bad thing to want to go back to Godhead. You know, that should I desire, you know, what's wrong with me? Oh, you know, what is wrong with me? I'm thinking I would like to go back to Godhead, you know, therefore I cannot practice pure devotional service. But, you know, we actually see in this canto that in the 7th chapter, and I think it's about text number 5 or something, Krishna said to Uddhava, don't remain here. After I've gone, do not remain here in the material world. You go back to Godhead. So for Uddhava to practice pure devotional service, he would have to develop that desire to go straight back to Godhead in order to please Krishna. To please Krishna, to please the Guru, if one desires to go back to Godhead, to please them, then that is pure devotional service. If Krishna and the Guru decide that you should remain here and do some service and we're designed, then that may be something different. But you see, you know, especially in Kali Yuga, and there is so many instructions by Srila Prabhupada, you know, go back to the spiritual world. And I've heard, you know, one disciple saying, oh, Srila Prabhupada, you know, I'd like to stay here and preach, you know. No, don't do that, he said. Go back to Godhead. Not in Kali Yuga. Don't dilly dally. See? So, you know, if the Guru desires that you go back to Godhead, Krishna desires, then the devotee will accept that and is pleasing to the Lord. It's not that we can never think, you know, oh, I can never think I'd like to go back to Godhead. If Krishna comes to get me, I'll hide somewhere. You know, he'll never get me, you know, because it's I'll be breaking some regular principle like that. So, but that is that, you know, nādhanam nājanam nāsandhanam kavatam bhajagirisikam. Actually, my spiritual master, when I took initiation, one of his instructions, he said, become a pure devotee, go back to Godhead. So, you know, I have no choice. I have to desire to go back to Godhead. And it's a fact. So, you know, if I didn't have a desire to go back to Godhead, I'd be offensive. Yeah, thinking I know better. So anyway, here, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura, actually in commenting on that verse, and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, they describe that Lord Chaitanya is giving very good instruction how to come to the platform of pure devotional service and actually develop bhava and prema. First, of course, to come to the first stage of prema bhakti, which is bhava bhakti, that is actually love of God in its budding stage. And they describe that if the sataka, if their attachment, to sensual pleasures, whether it be subtle or, you know, gross, is not severed, then their original spiritual identity will not manifest. You know, as long as the spirit soul has these unwanted coverings in the form of anathas, you know, desiring something else than what the pure spirit soul would be desiring, then the pure nature, the pure identity of their spiritual existence will not manifest. And because that does not manifest, the bhakti which they're trying to practice will not transform into bhava, which is, you know, amorous spiritual emotions. So, you know, when these desires, material desires, in all various different forms, when they're severed and one is practicing bhakti, then it allows the essential characteristic of the spirit soul to manifest itself. But it won't the spirit soul will not manifest its original nature, characteristic, identity until such time. But when it does, then the bhakti that they're practicing transforms into bhava, which is, you know, spiritual emotions. In other words, in order to have spiritual desires, we have to first, become free from material desires. My spiritual master puts it in a very simple way that, you know, bhava bhakti begins when sex desire finishes. A very simple way of putting it. Considering, of course, that basically sex life is the central pivot point of all pleasures in the material world, so to cut to the chase. It's described, in that verse by Rupa Goswami that pure devotional service, the primary characteristic of pure devotional service is this bhava or prema, this love of God. That is the primary characteristic. But that primary characteristic, the secondary characteristic, of course, is freedom from desires for karma, jnana and yoga. But unless that secondary or preliminary characteristic manifests, then the primary characteristic won't manifest. See? So when a devotee is performing devotional service and that preliminary or secondary characteristic manifests, that there is no more desire for karma, jnana, yoga, any other ulterior motive, then the primary manifestation of bhakti will manifest, and that is the bhava and the prema. And that, of course, is called uttama bhakti. Speaking of uttama bhaktis, go ahead. Until such time that the bhakti actually remains bhaktivas, or a shadow of devotion. It's not quite the real thing. Srila Prabhupada, in many lectures, I've heard him describe how, when you actually, when a devotee comes to that platform of Brahman, they're not hankering or lamenting for anything in the material world, not subtle or gross, that's when real devotion begins. And he's talking about that platform of bhava bhakti. It is that bhava prema which actually attracts the Lord. Again, there are different statements Srila Prabhupada makes, that it's not actually the mechanical process of hearing and chanting which awards the perfection. It rests solely upon the mercy of the Lord. In other words, sadhana bhakti does not in itself produce bhava bhakti. As one practices, it's not that you do the steps 1, 2, 3, boom, bhava bhakti manifests. It's not, You perform sadhana, and if the Supreme Lord, by His causeless mercy, bestows His mercy upon you, He will reward that sadhana with that goal of bhava and prema, love of God, out of His causeless mercy. It's not automatic. It's not that you do it and he's obligated, and there's a certain time limit. And I've been chanting for 6 years now, so Krishna must give the bhava bhakti. You can chant for so many millions of years, and it is completely dependent upon Krishna's mercy. Therefore, when we chant, it's not just we're advised not to just chant, but to chant sincerely, and like the cry of a child for its mother. There's got to be some, loam or strong desire that please Krishna. Give me the opportunity to serve you in pure devotional service, like that. There's got to be some intensity to that chanting. If that intensity is not there, we can chant. And Krishna may or may not, award. He's not obligated. It's not just a mechanical process, especially if there are offences. Generally, mechanical chanting means offences. Whereas, a person who's very sincerely chanting and with a strong desire, to attract Krishna's mercy, they're very, very careful not to, commit offences, any of the 10 offences. One who doesn't have that, their chanting can be mechanical. They're going through the process. So there has to be that sincere desire, some intensity, some greed, some great longing for Krishna, and understanding that it is totally dependent that Krishna will bestow His mercy, as we're following. But of course, as we described about a week ago, Krishna is very, very inclined to those devotees who are following the orders of His pure devotees. So our chanting may be mechanical, we may lack that greed and intensity, but still, if we're very, very fortunate that we've taken shelter of devotees who are very, very dear to Krishna, then Krishna is still very inclined to bestow that mercy upon His pure devotees, followers, just for, because they're trying to execute that order. But one who actually performs devotional service, even to Krishna, as we described, there are many Vaishnavas who are not actually Vaishnavas, but even among the Vaishnavas, those who perform devotional service independently without taking shelter of Krishna's pure devotee, is almost impossible then for them to in fact transform that sadhana into bhava bhakti or prema bhakti. Rupa Goswami describes that there are 6 characteristics of pure devotional service. Two of those characteristics belong to sadhana bhakti, 2 belong to bhava bhakti, and 2 belong to prema bhakti. Let's see if we can remember them. So sadhana bhakti, there is relief from all distress, suffering, and the beginning of all auspiciousness. Bhava bhakti, there is what's that? It is very, very rare, and it brings happiness. What is that? it derives liberation. Yeah. And in Prema Bhakti, he controls Krishna, and is incalculably condensed spiritual bliss. So, is that Sandrananda? Okay. Okay. So, within those, you notice that the one in Bhava Bhakti, is it, that is very, very rare, and the fact that in Prema Bhakti that it has the ability to control Krishna, therefore it's also very, very rare, they're similar. In the first instance, in Bhava Bhakti, they both those qualities means that they have the ability to attract Krishna and to, you know, bring Krishna under one's control, to attract him like that. The Bhava Bhakti, he is able to attract the attention of Lord Sri Krishna, whereas and begins practicing pure devotional service. Whereas the Prema Bhakta, he also attracts Krishna, but Krishna becomes so attracted that he awards him personal and direct service, you know, personal direct reciprocation. But both of them are attracting Krishna to different degrees. And again, last week we described how, you know, Krishna has many devotees, but there are different degrees of superiority in their bhakti. And according to those degrees of superiority, even among the Prema Bhaktis, there are different degrees of attraction. So the devotee who attracts Krishna the most is Srimati Radharani. Krishna is called Madana Mahan and Srimati Radharani. So he is the attractor of Cupid, and Srimati Radharani is Madana Mahan Mohini, the attractor of Cupid. So she attracts Krishna, her devotion attracts Krishna and controls Krishna more than any other devotee. So bhakti is like a process of purification, and the more that purification is there, one develops very good pure qualities related to serving Krishna, and Krishna becomes attracted. In the same way that if we have a magnet that's very rusty, it cannot attract, you know, metal objects. Or is it the metal objects? They're very rusty. But if you polish them up, then, you know, the attractive quality is there, you know, much stronger. So it's like that. Devotional service is like that. So therefore, devotees, knowing that Radharani, you know, attracts Krishna so much that she practically has, you know, complete control of Krishna, therefore they take shelter of Srimati Radharani, because they know that you know, if Radharani desires that Krishna, you give your blessings to, you know, this devotee of mine, and Krishna will immediately do that. They know Radharani has that potency. So therefore, you know, the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, they take shelter of Srimati Radharani, Srimati Radharani's assistants, such as the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, and all the Acharyas coming down in their line. They're generally associates of Srimati Radharani, and by taking shelter of them, then it guarantees that Krishna will become attracted to one's devotional service. But the point being that it is this Bhava Bhakti and Prema Bhakti, which is a symptom of pure devotional service, which actually attracts Krishna even to the point of bringing him under the control, whereas all other forms of sadhana, even practiced by those who profess to be Vaishnavas, that do not evoke that unalloyed devotion, Krishna is not attracted just by the external, their vast knowledge of the Vedas, and yet there's not a tinge of pure devotional service in their understanding. Their great austerity and renunciation, and yet there's they're renouncing things which should be used in Krishna's service. People performing all sorts of pious work, just like charity. People give in charity. People will give gifts to even the most wretched of people, but they won't give anything to Krishna. They're so pious that they'll give to even the most undeserving people, and they'll forgive and make allowance and make sacrifices for very degraded people, engaged in all sorts of abominable activities, who've put themselves in a wretched condition by the sinful activities. So people, pour their heart out and give them. And if someone says, you give to Krishna, he is supreme. Oh no, I have nothing for him. This is their piety. So, Krishna is, and yet, whatever these so-called charitable people are giving, just like in the 16th chapter, you see that the demoniac mentality is described, that so much charity I have given. I will give more and more. What are they giving? What are they giving to these sinful people? They're giving Krishna's property that I have stolen from Krishna, and then I take that, and the people who are most offensive to Krishna, I reward them. this is their piety. So, when there's not a trace of devotional consideration for Krishna, it is certainly not very attractive to Krishna. So, again, this verse describing that pure unalloyed devotional service, therefore, is the topmost process, and it brings the ultimate perfection of attracting the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and no other process can actually give that goal, no matter how exalted they may appear to be. So just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments about any of those things. First of all, we have to consider the influence of Kali Yuga. So, Krishna described to Uddhava that particularly because of the influence of Kali Yuga, it's not recommended that even an exalted person like Uddhava stay. Of course, he had a particular mission while he was still living, Uddhava, to preach. But he was advised, that after that time that he returned to the spiritual world. Because Kali Yuga is, you know, it gets to the point, and I've heard Srila Prabhupada describing the characteristics of Kali Yuga. It gets to the point where you cannot preach. There is no one to preach to. So what will you do? If you decide, I won't go back to that, I'll stay and preach. And then you find that people are less than animals. And you cannot preach to anyone. And they just want to kill you, eat you, whatever. What preaching will you do? You know, we can't quite imagine how, you know, absolutely horrifying Kali Yuga becomes. Especially Kali Yuga, it's not recommended. You know, for some time, but if you end up somehow making a little delay, you know, and you end up in the thick of Kali Yuga and a little contaminated by remaining a little too long in such a contaminated place, then you're in all sorts of trouble. It's very risky. Yeah, what was that?
Often we also saw self-systems unimaginable, that Kali Yuga was going to continue for such a long time, even though it's like looking at the problem is just because we can see the rapid progress of Kali Yuga already, and I think it's that from my childhood to now, how things just go so incredibly fast that how can you understand that? And also often people, they, you know, they think like, the first time here about Kali Yuga, they think it's going to end in a couple of years because they can't imagine the progress of it.
Oh yes, Kali Yuga is progressing at a rapid rate, and you know, the only reason it's really still people are able to live here with any sort of sanity is because of the Hare Krishna movement, which is holding back phenomenally, you know, the radical influences of Kali Yuga as far as possible. But even with that, you can still see it progressing for those, you know, where the Sankirtan movement doesn't reach them at this stage. But you know, what to speak of in the future. Even now, I was listening to one conversation Srila Prabhupada was having with Tamal Krishna. Of course, we know that Tamal Krishna Maharaj was asked to go to China and to preach. There was a conversation. Tamal Krishna and a couple of devotees, they read, you know, the history of Mao Zedong and his policies and everything like that, and they were trying to find some tiny little loophole by which they can enter into there. And they were discussing with Srila Prabhupada. And as the discussion went on, you know, both Srila Prabhupada and Tamal Krishna and the others, you know, realized that there was just, they were so crazy in, you know, their policies and their philosophy and their view of life that there was nothing. There was nothing that they could. And Srila Prabhupada said, so just don't even try. He said, you know, we'll leave that, you know, to our descendants, you know, that perhaps, you know, the second, third generation or someone down the line may, you know, have at that stage by Krishna's arrangement, of course some hope may come. But he was saying, you know, you cannot preach in certain circumstances, and just don't go there, you know, at that stage. Of course, you know, gradually, obviously, you know, opportunities have opened up in, you know, many places of the world which were practically impossible to enter. But Srila Prabhupada's policy was certainly, you know, if there's an opportunity, take it. But if it's just that difficult, and people are that much rascals and determined not to be Krishna conscious, then just leave it and preach where it's favourable. So that's even in these current times. What to speak of, you go thousands of years down the track, or hundreds of years down the track, when people are, just less than animals.
So does that mean like nuclear wars which kind of interrupt that process of Kaliyuga but it's building up again? Because like it looks so far that like it looks like it's gonna be in a couple of thousand years if it's gonna be at this point. So there's like some smaller devastations that people have to build up and which would stop the problem from that comes from Kaliyuga but it doesn't interrupt it or?
Krishna makes different arrangements. Prabhupada describes that for certain races of people and certain groups of people, the only opportunity that there will be for preaching is when they become completely and utterly ruined. Until that time, they will not listen to anything, and there is no use preaching them. So some are like that. They're in that position, and they're just smashed completely, and they're just in utter despair and hopelessness. Then there may be an opportunity for devotees to preach, and that comes in the form of course, wars, and floods and disease and and poverty and things like that.
Prabhupada talks that there's so many acharyas that preach personalism.
Personalism?
Yeah. Mm. And there's this one acharya who preaches personalism, but it has such a far-reaching effect. Is that because that's what people desire?
Yeah, people want to be cheated. People want to be cheated. So it's a lot easier to say to people that you can become perfect by just doing as you please and have as much sense gratification as you can, and that will lead you to perfection. If you tell people like that, then they'll accept that very easily. If you tell people that you have to give up sense gratification, materialistic life, they're not interested. Very difficult. So, if a devotee is very, very expert, which they should be, they can, gradually, even to people who are very, very stubborn, there are amongst them innocent people who are at least willing to listen, at least willing to hear. They're very attached to sense gratification and so much sinful activity and what have you, but they're innocent in the sense that at least they'll hear you, and if you can give them some reasonable and attractive arguments and statements, they'll gradually come around. I listened to Srila Prabhupada was explaining that people want to enjoy. Right? So one argument he says that if you want to enjoy, then first you have to know how to enjoy. So of course, so far people are interested. Oh yes, okay, I want to enjoy, and here's, you can teach me how I can enjoy. So then he explains that you can't enjoy if you're he gives the example that, for instance, when people have sex life, they don't want to actually wear contraceptives because it covers the pleasure. So he explains that also But when people want to, you know, have sex life, they like to become naked. So he explains that you can't actually enjoy sex life properly when all your everything is covered up. So he gives the example that because the spirit soul, the senses are actually covered over, you can't actually enjoy. So the whole material life is like that, that, you know, all our senses are actually covered over, and therefore you can't actually properly enjoy. And if you really want to enjoy, you actually have to become purified of the material senses and the material body. Yeah, it's not the sort of example that you would give to everyone, but for the particular audience, and I was surprised that some of them were sannyasis, that he, you know, he's just talking amongst his disciples, and what have you. So you don't sort of use that example willy-nilly to all sorts of people, because they, you know. But, you know, you can use other examples. I sometimes, I've changed that a little bit to make it a little bit more, you know, I've said, like, try eating, you know, with a sock on your tongue, you know. So it gives you the same picture, you know, you just, you know, it's, So material life is like that. So although people are very, very stubborn and very attached to sense enjoyment, if you're reasonable and, you know, according to the different audience, it is possible to show them that there is a higher enjoyment you want to enjoy. No one's saying don't enjoy, but you really, you're not enjoying, and you can't enjoy when your spiritual form and spiritual senses are covered by this gross material body. So, you know, Krishna consciousness is, as we described in the beginning, you know, by cutting one's attachment to the to desires for material sense pleasure, it allows the pure spiritual identity of the soul to manifest. And in that uncovered state, one experiences, you know, desires and pleasures and activities in relationship to the Supreme Lord. And but without severing that attachment to material enjoyment, that original pure spiritual identity will never manifest. As described earlier, that therefore the bhakti that one is attempting to perform doesn't transform into bhava or amorous spiritual emotions in relationship to the Supreme Lord. So in that example, you appear to be telling people what they want to hear, but you take them in a whole different direction. That's one of the tricks in preaching, that people want to hear something, some particular thing, so you actually appear to be telling them what they want to hear. But and they follow them, yes, because they want to hear that, they will follow you. But then you just take it a couple of steps and they think, oh, that's a natural progression, but I didn't realise we were going there like that. So, you know, for instance, people want to be one with God. And we say, well, there's something better than that. You know, that the here we see that Krishna says, you know, one with God, what is that? You know, my pure devotees control God. You know, they're more than God. So, in that sense, you know, you sort of, you can take people in the direction they want to hear, but you're actually systematically taking them to bhakti. In the beginning they think you're taking them to sense gratification and becoming one with God. You can take them apparently in that direction, but you're taking them to bhakti. That's the art of preaching. And, you know, people want to become one with God. We say, yes, you're one with God. In quality, we have no argument with that. And through bhakti yoga, you can actually very quickly become one with God, because you develop your spiritual nature, and therefore you can realize the spiritual nature of the Supreme, but different in quantity. So then you take them a little bit further. But so far they're eager to hear, because they're getting what they want, apparently, that oneness. Any other questions or comments? So I will go to the Prabhupada.